The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to kuci.org for the latest program schedule.
Good morning and welcome to this April 2nd, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can check us out on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always check out Barbara's website, penonfire.com. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Nicole, Barbara, and I are here with authors to talk about craft, content, and writing. Nicole is in studio this morning as well. She'll be up in the second half hour. But first, I'm joined by short story writer Jim Gavin, and Nicole will be here with Jennifer Gilmore and her new novel, The Mothers. Be sure to stay tuned for that. Jim Gavin worked as a sports writer, a plumbing salesman, and a Jeopardy production assistant. He's a former Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford University. He received his MFA from Boston University in 2011. His fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, Zizova, and Slice magazine. He lives right here in Southern California, where his work is largely set. Middlemen is his first collection of short stories, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So you had this lovely, like, fairy tale ride that every writer fantasizes about, taking an adult extension class and then, you know, suddenly ending up with this Stegner Fellowship, and your unsolicited work was accepted by The New Yorker. So clearly you connected with an audience. So I want to give you a chance to talk about the work and the collection and what it is these middlemen, what it is about them that's striking such a deep chord.
Well, when people ask me about the book, I usually describe it as a tour of all my failed careers, which there have been several. And for me, the book started taking shape, when I started taking adult education classes. And I was about 30 at that point. And up until that, I had some vague notion of wanting to be a writer. And I was trying to write about things or topics that I thought were, like, literary or kind of worthy of things set in Europe, stuff like that, where I've never been. And but around 30, I kind of settled into myself, and I started writing about my own life, which was kind of a new thing. And a lot of that had to do with my work life, whether it was in plumbing or writing about sports or, all the things I've done. And that was kind of my way in to, finding a voice, really, as a writer. And, after that, for the next few years, that's what kind of went into the book, was trying to make sense of my own life here in Southern California.
It's funny because I was trying to decide if these stories could exist in any generation or if they're rather specific to this one, because in some ways they feel very universally true of the male experience, you know, because I know so much about the male experience. but in other ways, they feel very grounded to this generation of men, this generation where, you know, you don't have a career for 35 years. We're kind of making that transition into, you know, different jobs and a non-traditional maleship from the 1950s. Any thoughts on whether these stories are uniquely this generation?
I think that's a good question. And then looking back, I can kind of see that there is a kind of generational a meditation on kind of generational things as far as what it means to have a career or be a man. The last story in the collection is about a man who's worked in the plumbing industry for 40 years, based on my dad, you know, and he, that's becoming more and more rare. And I think all the protagonists in the stories, they all kind of have this itinerant life, trying out different things, trying to find their niche. And that's becoming, more and more difficult. And I think a lot of these narrators have, protagonists have it in their mind that they're going to reach some place where everything will be settled and they'll be looking at the kind of maybe solid middle-class life that they were lucky enough to grow up in, and it's not there. It's not waiting for them, and they're going to have to readjust their expectations. in writing the book, I kind of had, and again, this was something I kind of figured out after most of these stories were written, there's a kind of a movement from apprentice to journeyman to master. Mm-hmm. And the early stories are kind of about young knuckleheads trying to figure out their way in life. And there are all these different jobs and vocations, but I think that movement, apprentice, journeyman, master, is more about just like being a person, what it means to live in life and be, be a human being.
Right, right. Yeah, there were so many quiet truths in these stories. You know, there weren't car chases and murders and dead prostitutes. There were just a lot of poignant, humorous, sad truths about human nature and being a man. And you sustain this wonderful focus and interest. And I was wondering if you could talk about creating quiet characters, kind of quiet storylines, but sustaining such a high level of interest in your characters.
I don't know. I think I have kind of two. I'm not a writer who I'd say depends on plot, you know, and but I do believe like it's important to entertain the reader, and even if it is a quieter story without explosions per se, and so. On a craft level, one thing I've kind of figured out is in a lot of these stories, in the early pages, you find out the character's waiting for something. And that waiting has a sense of longing and expectation to it, whether it's in the first story, there's a young man who's waiting for this big basketball game he's going to play, and the reader knows that's down the line. And that kind of pulls the story along, that expectation, that waiting. And along the way, you can, you know, make all these little detours, but you're always kind of coming back to this moment that a character is either waiting for and longing for or dreading in some way. And so that's kind of, that's how I get away with not having too much plot, I think. And the other thing for me is just on the entertainment level. I consider myself a comic writer. In college, my dream would have been to write for The Simpsons or, you know, something like that. And I just didn't know how to enter that world, so I compensated with literary pretensions. But my goal is always to entertain and make the reader laugh. And for me, a big thing for me as a writer was kind of learning that those, like, literature and comedy are not these two mutually exclusive things. And most of the writers I like make me laugh on a profound level. And it's, so that's always something I'm going for.
Right. I think as between writing for The Simpsons and writing for The New Yorker, that, I don't know, you didn't choose poorly.
I think I'm lucked out.
My guest this morning is Jim Gavin. The book is Middlemen, his first collection of short stories. You're listening to Writers on Writing. So you've lived in Southern California most of your life, and I've lived here 25 years, so maybe we're both biased on this point. But the stories seem to work uniquely well set in sort of these lesser-known and glamorous quiet suburbs of L.A. and Orange County. And, you know, I don't know if it's the proximity to Hollywood or the relentless sunshine or Mexico or what it is, but what do you think it is about Southern California that feeds these stories so well?
Yeah, a part of it, I think, is that I really don't know any place else, and so there's a kind of inevitability to me writing about it. For a long time, I tried to avoid it, at different points, I mean, I lived in Northern California at one point, and for me, that was like... you know, going to Europe, or that was like, I was so felt so far away, and I didn't understand like Southern California until I had left it for a little while. But in general, I think there's a kind of a mood and a type of person that I just know pretty well here. And I think probably versions of them live in different parts of the country, but here there's something specific. I mean, my dad is like a third generation Long Beach guy. And, this is a man who, you know, was drafted, fought in Vietnam, you know, worked in plumbing for 40 years, and yet he's kind of like just the most laid-back dude. And there's a certain attitude towards life that I think in the, like, kind of fringe areas of Southern California that aren't portrayed very much in books or movies, there's a a certain contentment towards the kind of goofball aspects of life. I worked at a gas station for 5 years, and the type of guys I worked with, we all love that job, which is kind of sad, but we were kind of hanging out, you know, looking at cars, seeing friends, listening to the ball game, and that was kind of enough. And so I think there's something about Southern California. You know, most people come here, California will always be like a gold rush, always have a gold rush mentality, whether it's in Southern California and like the entertainment industry or Northern California and the tech industry, like people come here to take something, you know, and I think being a native, I have that same mentality too, in a certain sense, but being a native, I think I'm able to just kind of see the more quiet aspects of living here. You know, whether it's something as simple as just like just being, you know, relatively close to the beach, the mountains, just I feel like there's no place else I want to be, which could be a sign of a total lack of ambition and laziness, but that's also maybe a characteristic of natives of Southern California.
It's such a life on the freeway here, and that kind of plays into the middleman aspect, too, that you're always between places, right? You're always stuck trying to get someplace where you're not, and, you know, traversing horrible traffic to get there. I don't know.
Right.
So I want to pick up on this notion that you've brought up a couple of times, which is where autobiography leaves off and fiction begins, that a lot of these characters either have life experiences, job experiences that are based on something similar to your own life. And I've noticed when I try and fictionalize things from my own life, from myself, I can never quite get it true enough, or, you know, something seems lacking. But I wanted you to talk about that process of autobiography to fiction.
Yeah, I think for me, I've never had, or anytime I've had like an idea for a story, like that would be an interesting thing to write about. It just never quite comes off, and that could be a total lack of imagination on my part. And I think what I've learned to harness my lousy imagination, and for me, like all the stories in this collection kind of represent or began with some moment in my life that has kind of haunted me. Or they just stayed with me in some way. And in most of the stories, it took years to figure out kind of what that meant. And you don't kind of figure it out by just sitting around thinking about it. You write your way into an understanding. And I guess I could have, in some of these, most of these cases, could have written a memoir. But fiction just allows you to make leaps that, in your own understanding and sense of the world, that I don't think a memoir would, and that's why I love fiction. Every story, there's a moment where a character is invented or a situation is changed just slightly enough that the autobiographical aspects are still there, but it turns into its own thing. And that's always the kind of moment I'm looking for. In the first story is kind of about my high school basketball career, and there's a character in there who's kind of the antagonist. He's another, it's about a kid who transfers to a new school, and there's a kid there who kind of looks like him, but is a little bit older and is kind of this antagonist. And I've been trying to write a high school basketball story for a decade, and I was trying to write my story, and I just couldn't get it right, like you're saying. And it was just somehow this character walking on stage, who was a total invention, that made that story suddenly, oh, I understood what it was. And that's kind of what fiction can do. And that's what I'm always looking for, just trying to write my way into a moment where what I know about the world is just slightly changed. And then I have to see everything in a new way, and that usually creates a kind of energy and excitement in the writing.
Mm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess the follow-on question to that is the work of the short story as opposed to the work of the novel, we kind of covered memoir here, but what makes an effective short story versus an effective novel, and what the short story can do that other forms of fiction can't do?
know. I think a quote I think about a lot is I think I remember Tobias Wolff saying this, but I think he was quoting Gabriel Garcia Marquez. So I'll give the credit to both of them for this. But he said, I think Gabriel Garcia Marquez said that a novel you can win by TKO, but a short story you have to win by knockout. And that just kind of made sense to me on some level. I think certain stories, a story just has an intensity to it that I think a novel can be more of a like a long drive with a companion, you know, like a cross country drive. And a short story feels more like, you know, you arrive at a diner and something weird happens, then you keep going, but that moment stays with you. And so I think the pleasure of the short story is that kind of intensity where you sit down for a half hour, and then when you close the pages, the world looks a little different. And that's what I'm always going for. There's a short story called, it's well known, Chopin in Winter by Stuart Dybeck. Mm-hmm. And that's a story I pick up a couple times a year. And I think it's just so incredibly beautiful and perfect in its way. And I think it could only exist as a short story. It couldn't be expanded or cut down at all. It's its own perfect length. And it has a complete movement to it. And so that's what I'm always looking for in a short story, like, is that movement and sense of change where the reader doesn't need any more. Like, what came before and what comes after the action you present is implied, or you don't need to explain it anymore. And that's why I love short stories.
Me too. Yeah, if you write too much, you write the magic out of it. That's so true.
Yeah, totally.
My guest this morning is Jim Gavin. The book is Middlemen. Speaking of Tobias Wolff, I know you worked with him and with Hodgin and with some other great great writers. And I'm curious what these men impart on you, and sort of how working with other writers, if you know, how much talent can be taught, how much craft can be taught, and what sort of little gems you took away from these men.
Yeah. Well, the writer who's had the biggest influence on me is Lou Matthews, who's a great Southern California writer, and he's the one I took classes with at UCLA Extension. And Lou, for me, just kind of changed the way I think about fiction. And he basically asked, you know, help me simplify things and what you're actually trying to do. Your job as a fiction writer is to write with clarity and through your senses, and not worry about what things mean in a certain sense. I think becoming a fiction writer, and Flannery O'Connor says something like this, is almost a process of making yourself dumb and just being able to willing to write in a really simple and clear way. And then you kind of can build up to other things. So Lou was instrumental in that. And with Tobias Wolff, again, I'm really lucky to have work with someone, you know, who's a total master. And what I appreciate about Tobias was that he took every story on its own terms. He seemed as comfortable with a kind of comic realist story or something that was totally off the rails, and you know, and I found that approach really to be helpful. And I don't know, the thing that I think you take from working with someone like Tobias Wolff or Hodgin is basically almost their just attitude towards fiction in general and how sacred they consider it and how much they seem to enjoy it. You know, these are both men who probably don't need to be teaching, but they really enjoy just talking about stories. And that's just inspiring on its own. And, that's why, you know, it's why I care about fiction so much. Mm.
Don't you love it when people quote you back to you? Because you have a great quote on this that I read that's sort of apropos of this. And you said, I have total faith in fiction. I struggle to write. It's the absolute hardest thing in the world, but I never struggle with whether or not I should be writing, or if fiction is worthwhile or a relevant form, or if language can truly convey experience, or if there's any true meaning in the world. I'll let the Ivy kids sort that stuff out. I thought that was a great quote.
Oh,
I'm going to pin that to my computer or something. So were there stories in here that gave you a particular heartburn or difficulty, and characters that you got stuck with, or some other thing that you struggled with in one of these stories and how you got yourself out of it?
Yeah, one of those stories, it's kind of towards, I guess, the second to last story, which has a long title, Bewildered Decisions in Times of Mercantile Terror, which I lifted from J.P. Dunleavy, his novel, Fairy Tale of New York. But that story was, in some way, that might be my favorite in the collection because it kicked my butt. Like, I worked really hard on it and wrote so many different versions. And it's the only story in the collection that has kind of contrasting points of view. And one of the points of view is a woman. So there's a man and a woman, a young man and his cousin. And in the original version, it's just from the guy's point of view. And I just couldn't get it right. And then at some point, it was a moment that I think as a writer you're always kind of like hoping for, and you get it now and then, where I just started, without much thinking about, just started writing from his cousin's point of view. And then the story just suddenly made sense, and that I figured out it suddenly had a structure. I could go back and forth. They have these kind of back and forth sections, and each section comments on the other and fills in the blank of the other. And so that was satisfying. And then the end, I probably rewrote that ending dozens of times. And at some point, I just realized kind of what it had to be. I realized that the story was kind of a duet. Hmm. And kind of like the Pogue song, A Fairy Tale of New York, which is, they took the title from J.P. Dunleavy. That's one of the great duets ever. And the characters, well, in the song, the chorus is sung together. And these two characters have been separate throughout the story. In the end, they come together. And I realized that they needed to be kind of singing together in some way. There needed to be some exchange between them. And once I kind of figured that out, I was able to finally, like, write the ending that I wanted and felt the most satisfying. So, yeah, it's weird. I think some stories, I probably worked on that story for a couple years. The longest story in the collection, which is called Elephant Doors, it's about 50 pages. That I wrote really fast, and I remember having no angst about it. It just kind of came out. And so now and then you get one of those, but I think the ones you really struggle on, it's really satisfying when you kind of crack the code, at least in your own mind.
Right, right. There's so many sickly, elderly, dying women in here. Seems like all of the women are in various states of decrepitude or death. And I wanted to get your take on that.
I can say that I don't think any of these stories, I started writing all these stories after the death of my mother. And, and I think that's at some point, I think that's when I started writing about my own life. Like is it everyone who goes through that, it changes you fundamentally. And in also ways you don't realize. I didn't set out to do that, but it's what I did, and it's there is, a kind of working through of what you're going through. And another aspect of that is, like, my mom worked in in convalescent care, and so did my aunt and grandma, and mm-hmm. I've always been around a lot of old dying people. I don't know, so maybe something like that comes out. But Yeah, I don't know. I know that's the reason why, but I can't explain quite how it comes out or why. But, you know, those types of experiences, you're going to write about them whether you know it or not.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. It works so well. It's love. The unconscious is so lovely, right? I mean, it does all this other dirty work that we don't even know what it's doing. But it's,
exactly.
It works out. Jim Gavin, we've run out of time, but I always have like 18 more questions and too short a time. But this was a huge pleasure. Where can we can find you online? Yeah.
Yes, I have a little poorly maintained website. I'm on Twitter. My website's jim-gavin.com, and my Twitter handle is @jim@deltaco. So
I love that. We've seen some Del Taco in these stories. That's fantastic.
Yes, yeah, it's probably the closest I have to like a Wagnerian leitmotif.
Did you have any last minute words of writing advice or wisdom for writers?
I don't know. I feel like I'm a product of adult education, and if you're wondering about trying it, try it. You know, it kind of is a nice way to spend a Tuesday night.
It totally panned out. Wonderful. Jim Gavin, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Jim Gavin. The collection is Middlemen. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with us. Nicole Nelson will be back with Jennifer Gilmore. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. The show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. You can also check out our new Facebook page, Writers on Writing KUCI-FM. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson, and our guest for this half of the show is Jennifer Gilmore. Jennifer is the author of three novels, Her first, Golden Country, was a New York Times Notable Book of 2006 and a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Her novel Something Red was a New York Times Notable Book. Her work has appeared in magazines and journals including The Atlantic, Book Forum, Huffington Post, The Los Angeles Times, The New York Times, and Psychology Today. Today we'll talk about her third and most recent novel, The Mothers, published by Scribner and out this month. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So your new novel, The Mothers, could you introduce it to us?
Sure. The Mothers is a novel, and it's about a couple who, after many years of trying to have a child, are embarking on an open adoption, which means they will know the birth mother and maybe the birth father of the child. And they've been on, it's a very long and arduous journey for them, and it sort of chronicles that process.
Yes, and in the book, you're open about having gone through your own adoption process. And so I was wondering, what made you choose to go the novel route with the story as opposed to the memoir?
Sure. Yeah. In the book, I don't talk about my own experience. I talk about my protagonist, Jessie's experience, which is a little bit different than mine, but it certainly resembles it. And I am very different than Jessie, who's very angry and very caustic and sort of and hilarious, but also she's pretty desperate to have a child. My husband and I, yes, I've written a lot about it. I've written for Vogue and the New York Times and the Atlantic, so it certainly leaves me open to talk about it. But I chose to write a novel really because I'm a novelist. So while this was happening to us, and it was very painful and it was very protracted, I sort of thought, well, what's a way that I can make this interesting to myself so I don't kind of off myself? And I always think of fiction. And so it was really more like, how can I find a way to tell this story through novel, through fiction, as opposed to through memoirs? I write a lot of personal essays, but for me, these issues that open adoption brings up, and adoption in general, about race and class and what it means to be a mother, what it means to want in general, really seems suited for a novel, which is not to say I couldn't have written a memoir or that there aren't many memoirs that have affected me very deeply. It's just the way I sort of see the world.
Okay. And when you're developing the character of Jessie, can you talk a little bit about that? How much consciousness went into differentiating her from yourself and like what your process was like with getting her voice?
Sure. It's not as if I sat down and I thought, okay, I have to make her really different than I am. But what I heard when I started was a voice, and it was her voice. My previous two novels that you mentioned, thank you for that lovely introduction, by the way, they're written in third person. They take place over 40 years, over many generations. And this was a very different book. It's first person. It was written, you know, Jessie saying, I feel this, I feel that. And that was very different for me. So we're really, really inside her head. And I wanted what was there inside to be, you know, very raw and very real, but also palatable to the reader. So she's different than I am. Her thought process is different than I am. Her marriage is different than I am. But it would be disingenuous marriage is different than I have. But it would be disingenuous to say that what they were going through didn't put the same kind of pressures on a marriage that we experienced, financial pressures, emotional pressures. So the circumstances in general, in this diffused way, were very similar. How we went about dealing with them, I really wanted to be especially hard on Jessie. And I felt like, again, doing a novel made that easier for me. I mean, she is not innocent in this. She does a lot of things that aren't, she's not a great person in all of this all the time. So, I really had to take risks with her and let her behave perhaps more badly than I behave. Also, you know, it's fiction. You have to make a lot of great plot twists and this kind of stuff happen.
Well, at this point, can you give us a flavor and read from the book?
Sure. Okay. I'm going to read, well, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. It's somewhat in the beginning of the book when Jessie is talking about embarking on an open adoption. In the end, Ramon and I decided on domestic adoption mostly because we desired an infant. I put out of my mind the notion that a mother could come back and take the child away and what that could feel like, because we were told that once there was a match with the birth mother, we could be in the delivery room holding her hand. The birth mother, we were told, would be like family. This became the fairy tale narrative we lived by, there from almost the beginning of our once upon a time. I imagined as we headed to this agency down south, away from New York and its difficult laws that few agencies were licensed in, that we would name our baby Grace. Like a lot of the adopted girls I knew, Grace, as in divine, as in God's grace, because of all we had to do to find her, the child that was ours from the ancient beginnings of time, but that we'd had to be tried and tested and trained to find. This is going to be great, I said, as if we were on our way to Club Med. I looked out at the road. We had just left 95, and now we were on the diminutive 85, which made us feel like we were headed somewhere undiscovered. But also, I said, I'm nervous. I've been thinking about it, said Ramon, still the fingertips gripping and ungripping the wheel. I'm going to speak Spanish to the child, no matter what the ethnicity. I'm going to speak Spanish and Italian. Ramon, I should add, is Spanish and Italian. As he said this, I felt a combination of psychotic rage and unbearable sadness. At first, my violence bordering anger was against all Europeans who, as we uneducated, isolated Americans know, speak so many languages. It quickly, however, honed in on Ramon. Really? I asked. Of course, I'm Spanish and Italian. My mother spoke to me in Italian. Sorry? Oh, my mother spoke to me in Italian for my entire childhood, and that's important to me to pass on. But I don't speak either of those languages, Ramon. It was my great shame that as many years as I'd been going to Terracina, I had never learned to speak Italian. Well, that is not my fault, Jesse. Do you have time for me to continue?
Oh, please,
I'm not sure
yes.
If I heard you there.
Oh, no. Please go ahead.
Okay. Well, that's not my fault, Jesse. He looks straight ahead. What will you do then? What will you pass on to the child? I didn't know if I would burst into tears or tear my husband's head off. What would I do? Take our African-American, Italian, and Spanish-speaking baby to Hebrew school? What will I pass on to the child, I said, more to myself than to Ramon? I remembered Passover at my great-grandmother's house in Cleveland, all the cousins rushing to find the afikoman, as if it held the key to something besides Nana Sadie's checkbook. Great-uncle Sid with his magic quarters, his colored scarves pulled out of the most unfathomable and now I see inappropriate places. Three generations, all at one table. I will be the one to break that. Yes, Ramon said, you have to think about legacy. My child would be heir to what? I closed my eyes as we drove, and I thought of Harriet asleep at my mother's feet. I thought with regret how we had spayed Harriet, and so we would never have her puppies. And just the thought of never seeing her or her likeness again made me breathe heavily, tears collecting at the corners of my eyes. And beneath all that was this. Where do I fit in here? Most women become pregnant, and they carry their babies, and then they breastfeed their infants who need them to survive. Ramon and I were the same. We were two bodies. The baby would need us equally, and yet Ramon would have his 17 languages and his countless rich cultural experiences to share. I didn't know what I could offer. Really, it was just this. Was I the mother? Wasn't I supposed to be the mother? Thank you.
Thank you. That was Jennifer Gelmore reading from her new book, The Mothers. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And what you read there touches on this theme that is so present in our culture today, you know, motherness, you've called it, which was a nice way to give it a new angle. But and it's there are the mommy wars, and mothers seem to be like this target in our culture. You know, if someone's not mothering the way that, you know, a certain person wants them to, that any criticism is fair game. And, you know, as a novelist, one opens oneself up to criticism. But with this book, it seems to take it to a new level. And I heard you on Terry Gross, and you were very open with your own experience. And some of the comments were just so judgmental and mean. Were you ready for that new level of, I don't know, feedback?
So you mean the comments after the interview?
In on the internet, yes.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think when you're female and a writer who writes in first person and you're writing about something as you know, charged as motherhood, you get a lot of stuff. I was not expecting that at all. I, as you note, I wrote a novel. I was expecting it to be seen as a novel, but because I've written so much nonfiction and I've done a ton of interviews, I have sort of opened myself up for people to judge me and my life. So when I talk about the interview process, I mean the adoption process, there are a lot of things that people don't want to talk about, which is, you know, how people talk about race, how people talk about money. And I was very frank about this because it was so shocking to me at first. So that's one aspect. You know, you say the word race, or you say African American, or you say Hispanic. My husband and I, and Jesse and Ramon in the book, were open to race, any kind of race, for their adopted child, but not everyone is like that, and I explained that, how that comes to be. So you say something like that, and instantly people, you know, have their hair stands on end. And also, I was often conflated with Jesse, and, you know, people would say, oh, she's going to be a terrible mother, or you're going to be a terrible mother to me. And it was shocking because I was, you know, I didn't open myself up to that. And then it made me think, well, what does it mean to be a terrible mother? And why are we having these, as you call them, the mommy wars? I mean, Jesse in the book hasn't even gotten there yet. She's just imagining what it would be like to be involved in that. She lives in Brooklyn. There's a whole scene of, you know, the Brooklyn mother scene that she's not really anxious to be a part of. But I think you open yourself up as a writer, as a female, as somebody who wants something, and that's a dangerous thing to a lot of people. But I was very surprised by it. I really, really was. And disappointed.
Right. In the context of these mommy wars, that's how I approached the book. I thought, wow, this is a whole other world of mommy war-ness, but... Yeah. You mentioned several essays about adoption that you've written in conjunction, you know, with the release of the book. And were those written after you had completed the book, or?
This book actually came out last year, so it was last April. It was a crazy time. In fact, the book was finished. It takes forever to publish a book. Before I knew the end of our story, it was very interesting to write a book about adoption and not know what was going to happen to us, not know if, when, how we would get a baby, what that baby would look like, what the birth family would look like, and it was all, you know, imagination and fantasy. As soon as the book came out in April, in January, we found our baby and brought our baby home. So it was this crazy time of having an infant, having, you know, this infant that just, it's like adoption is sort of wait, hurry up, you know, wait years and years, and then it just happens really fast. So we weren't totally prepared, ironically enough. And then I was writing these essays as the book was being published because, you know, your publisher encourages you to write as much as possible to get yourself out there in certain ways. And I've done, you know, this is my third time. It's not my first time to the rodeo with being a novelist. But it was really interesting to be writing now from the perspective of someone who had, in fact, been successful in adoption, even though my child was only 2 months old. And I had no idea really what motherhood was yet, even though I'd thought about it for so long and written about it in so many ways. And so a lot of the essays I was writing at that time were negotiating all that, negotiating how you tell the story of the adoption. How much do you tell? I mean, for a while, people would say, oh, my gosh, your son is so beautiful. And I'd say, oh, thank you, he's adopted, that's why. You know, like just, you know, explaining that his beauty does not come from me. So that was, you know, it's all interesting how much, and it all has to do with storytelling. How much do you tell? How much do you keep? How do you order your story? So that was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, do you remember that moment when you were writing the novel when the Jessie's point, I mean, we won't give a spoiler or anything, but I mean, in her course through the adoption process, it surpassed, you know, the point at which you were in your own life. Do you remember that, or is it just...
Oh, yeah, well, the book ended before I knew where I was in my own life. Mm-hmm. So she, the ending is a made-up ending.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so changing direction. So your first book came out in 2006, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And before that, you were a publicist.
Mm-hmm.
So
I was.
Can you talk a little bit about that experience? Because that's a, you know, it did having experience in that branch of publishing inform your writing?
That's an interesting question. I was the director of publicity at Harcourt, which is now Harcourt's merged with Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. So it's Houghton Mifflin Harcourt now. And it was, you know, like so many things, a wonderful experience and a hard experience. I was writing my first book before I took that job. So it didn't really inform my writing so much. But it is really hard to, whatever you do in a publishing house, if you're a writer, if you're an artist and you work in an art gallery, it's really hard to sort of see how the hamburger gets made and to do it. So I was on the editorial board. I would sit in and see sort of what went through and why, and it was really difficult. And my first book is about several generations of Jewish immigrants. And I had the fortune of knowing so many agents from what I did, and yet people expected a different kind of book from me. I was young. I lived in New York. And, you know, I think there were a bunch of, it was, you know, called too Jewish, and, you know, there were a lot of things going on with that. So that was difficult. And it's funny, ironic, I don't know what it is, that and I've talked to other publicists about this, as soon as you go have your own book, you become unable to be a publicist. Like, everything I knew about helping other people bring their books into the world, I just couldn't think for myself. And so, I mean, you know, that's why even publicists have their own publicists. So it didn't translate that well. But I was really fortunate to work in publishing. It's before publishing really changed. I mean, you know, the myth about publishing is everyone saying, the week before, the year before, the decade before, those were the great times of publishing. But it was before the Kindle and before digital publishing really went wild. And it was a really great time, and the people who work in publishing are creative, wonderful people, and it's an industry that I was really sorry to leave, but I couldn't really see myself doing both.
And that's so interesting that you weren't able to, you know, do it for yourself, or you had to hire...
fortunate. My book comes out with Scribner, and I had, you know, they have a publicity department just like Harcourt did. So I had a publicist for my book, not for being a publicist. But yes, thank goodness. It's also very hard to ask people to do things for you. You know, oh, hi, I'm Jennifer. Will you review my book? You know, that made me very, very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I've read about your new book is that it's being made into a movie by Rachel Weisz.
Yes. Hopefully. Yes, it's Rachel Weisz has, you know, agreed to, I don't know if the word's agreed, but she has signed on for the project, and she that would be wonderful and amazing, and there's a script being written now, and there's a director attached to it. So it seems to be moving forward, and that's really exciting.
That is exciting. Will you be involved at all as a consultant or anything?
Yeah, I'm consulting a little bit here and there. I hope to, and but I have to sort of trust that everyone else knows way more what how to make a movie than I do.
And in terms of excitement, you also have a panel coming up on the LA Times Festival of Books. Mm-hmm. Have you done that before?
Yes, I did it. I've actually done it for all my books. The LA Times Book Festival is always, I know it sounds really rah-rah woo, but it is like one of the highlights of having your book come out. And as you mentioned, my first book was nominated for the LA Times Book Prize for debut fiction, which was also one of the most exciting things that happened for me with that book. So I feel very close to the festival, as it were. And my panel is Mona Simpson, Jenny Ophiel, and Elizabeth Crane. And I have to say, it sounds like the most, I'm just so pleased to be with these group of incredible women. And it's called The Human Experience, not The Female Experience, which I'm especially happy about.
Right. And so that'll be the Sunday of the festival, April 13th at 1:30. And looking forward to that. And so, Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today. Before we let you go, for the writers listening, and maybe for those who are trying to mine their own difficult experiences in their work, can you offer any advice or inspiration?
Inspiration is hard, but and so is advice. But I never really liked to take any advice. But I would say, if in regards to mining your own personal work, that really, really going there, you know, really sort of, I at my office now where I teach, and so I think a lot about my students, and I always tell them you have to go there. And if you're, especially if you're, it's so hard when you're writing about personal experiences, we tend to sort of circle it and not want to go too deep because it's A, painful, and B, you don't want to give so much away of yourself even though you feel like you've chosen to do that. So my advice would be just go there, burn the house down, and once you make the decision, you have to stick with it. So that, and also to be patient with yourself.
Good. Well, Jennifer Gilmore, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
That was novelist Jennifer Gilmore. Her latest book is The Mothers, published by Scribner. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be back next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m., and please stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Sue coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.